what I don't know. And never hurt me. I live a life that's working for me. What I respect, you just can't see.
Hello and welcome to the Halloween edition of Stormy Weather. I am Maeolus Cephas, and I'm bringing you news from the front line in the end times. One more week closer to the eschaton. Happy Halloween to all you out there, all the goblins, ghouls, the saints, the ancestors, and the marching dead. Well, suggestion of Mrs. Cephas, I'm going to bring things down to basics, and I'm going to address a question that was posted at the blog recently regarding the links between the snake, the kundalini, and the DNA, etc. The very central spine of my thesis in the work Homo sapiens, which I'm just putting the finishing touches to now as we speak, and which I hope will be out next year from Adventures Unlimited, probably sometime in the spring. That's 2009. Well, my intention was to read some excerpts from Homo sapiens and see what that sparks in this old brain of mine. Hopefully it will lead to some sort of discovery, some sort of disclosure that will be of interest to you all. And that means I'm going to just sift through the work now, if you bear with me, you non-existent audience, you. And I'm going to see what comes out. I'm not going to do it entirely at random, although I may get to that anon. A little random dipping is always fun. What I want to do first of all is address this particular question and cover various basic subjects. Okay. What is DNA? According to Jeremy Narby, DNA and the cell-based life it codes for are an extremely sophisticated technology that far surpasses our present understanding and that was initially developed elsewhere than on Earth. End quote. The evolutionists may be right that man is evolved from the animals, but not in the way they think. According to occult legend, man was here first. Nevertheless, human DNA is indeed encoded with, made up of, the DNA of all other animals combined, and man is in effect the sum total of that information, an amalgam of the countless different strains or strands of organic creation. Human DNA contains all the digits pertaining to the other species and something extra besides. The serpent that is winged before the fall represents the very highest character in the sequence. The serpent that is fallen stands for the lowest. The snake, representing the DNA strand, is there at the beginning and he is there in the end. Like Ouroboros, its beginning is its end, and vice versa. When the serpent lost its wings, however, and was condemned to walk the dust, the earthly was disconnected from the divine and the lines went down. Man, now humanity, became a fully and grossly material being, wholly identified with physical or organic nature. Let us press on with that, from that little brief recap of Genesis. The serpent, initially a symbol of the divine in physical form, came to represent the principle of sexual regeneration, the means by which life propagates itself. The snake shedding its skin is likewise in imitation of this divine process, by which souls, projections of the divine, incarnate in a series of organic forms without ever being identified with these forms. They are regenerated indefinitely, while maintaining the same essential quality, that of energy. The snake is the original archetype representing organic existence itself, the cycle of life, death, and rebirth that all manifestations must undergo in order to partake of individual being. When this process is conscious, i.e. identified with the eternal energy that indwells, the snake is depicted with wings. Once the process becomes unconscious and the energy identifies with the temporary form it has assumed, the snake has lost his wings. Are you with me so far? Okay, the first turd came as quite a shock to Adam. Its snake-like shape may have cemented a growing fear and suspicion, and so begun a process of blame and recrimination of the serpent that continues to this day. It also coincides with the traditional theological moment in which both Adam and Eve realize their nakedness and experience shame for the first time, perhaps at the first sight or smell of that first excrement. And their shame instantly and radically reduces their status. Instead of becoming gods, they become outcasts, sinners. God was then seen as a force outside of themselves and themselves as separate from creation. Their first act was to hide from God inside the garden, that fig leaf. The pride of hubris led to the shame of banishment. Self-awareness, premature and unprepared for, became self-consciousness. It is here that the fall proper begins. Man lost his ability to read the code. Where once magic had been the means by which man partook of creation, and by which the gods expressed themselves through man, it became instead the only way for man to keep alive his connection to the gods and to nature. It was the sole means for him to remember himself, to reactivate the sleeping serpent of the DNA. And you might say that sorcery is nothing else but a means to this end, the means of awakening our connection to the earth and to the spirit, and of reactivating our DNA, so that the serpent can regain his wings, and that we may become aware of ourselves as a flow of energy, a wave, and not a particle, not merely the shell that contains the energy. And it'd be easy to see how, from this perspective of energy, of flow, there could be no good and evil, there could be no right and wrong, there could be no oppressors and oppressed, there could be no enslavement, there could be no disease, there could be no despair, there could be none of the elements that categorize our human existence as separate beings. We would have the option of experiencing ourselves as individuals, but it would not be dependent on a sense of isolation or disconnection, only in the sense of relation. And it may be that our perception of the universe as objects rather than energy, particles rather than waves, creates this illusion that we or anything can exist separate from everything else, when in actual fact it seems that a deeper reality is that what exists is the relationship between things. In other words, if you think of two points making a line, well, it may seem that we need the two points in order to draw a line between them, but once the line exists, there are no points. There is merely the line. And if that line becomes a sphere, then there's no beginning and there's no end. There's merely the motion, the constant motion on that line. And in a sense, the universe is formed, and everything in existence has no form but motion. That what we think of a form and structure is merely the motion of spirit through manifestation, through matter. And so as spirit moves in, through, and as matter, it creates these forms, these apparent forms. But in a sense, they're like the shells that it leaves behind. It's like the traces on an LSD trip when we move our hands through the air and we see the tracks that our motion leaves. Well, everything in existence leaves these tracks behind it. And I think essentially this is what matter is what structure and form is. It's the movement of spirit. And this is how creation occurs. What we think of as gods and archangels and angels are beings that are made up of pure sound, of pure motion. And I think that sound and motion are perhaps synonymous from a certain perspective, since they're both vibrations. And these geometrical forms that are created by motion and sound themselves, they not only sing themselves into being, but they sing the creation into being, just as the birds bring the dawn. And that's not just a metaphor, that's not just poetry. I think there's a very literal metaphysical truth behind this idea that we've been left just with the poetry and the romance of it, but we feel intuitively and in our hearts that there is a greater truth to this, a truth that is much deeper and more lasting than the truth of hammer and nails make a table. That creation is an act of love always, as every carpenter knows. In a sense, it's a byproduct, just as a child is a byproduct of the act of physical love. The universe is a byproduct of the love of spirit for matter. And matter in its raw state has no structure, has no form. It's only when spirit moves through it, as in the Genesis, that God moved across the surface of the waters. What I was getting at was that the angels, the archangels, the gods, these are the principles that, through their motion, through their music, create or give rise to what we know of as the laws of nature and the laws of physics. It's a spontaneous creative thing. And we in turn have that power, but we have become caught in entirely passive and receptive mode, a lunar mode, which we can only receive the light but we can't transmit it. So we are subject to the laws, just as the moon can't influence the light of the sun, it can only reflect it back, it's a passive receptacle that can pass on that light, that energy and that power, but it can't in any way shape it or direct it. And we're in a similar role where we are able to receive the experience of the creation, but we're not able to partake in it. We're passive, and so we experience this as just being subject to the laws of nature and the laws of physics. And primary among those laws, of course, is the law of entropy, the law of decay, which we know of as death. And this is our experience of the fallen intellect, our awareness of death as awareness of good and evil, of separation, has locked us into this passive role, which death is the active player, and everything we do is merely a reaction, or at best a response to death. The difference between a reaction and a response is that a reaction is fear-based and resistant. It's a withdrawal, it's a way to deny, compensate for the power and the presence of death in our lives. A response is actually meeting death head-on and establishing a relationship with it, responding to it, and using the idea of death to empower us. And this is the first step to active, becoming an active player in the universe so that the spirit can move through us. And this is sorcery, the most powerful tool of consciousness for the sorcerer is awareness of his or her death. Without that awareness, no sorcery is possible, but with it, everything becomes sorcery. Everything that death touches becomes power. Everything that we experience in our consciousness and through in our actions, if it is touched by the power of death, by the awareness of death, it becomes in itself empowered by that. It's a transformative touch, Pluto. And that sorcery also is alchemy, is another word, a more neutral word for sorcery. I use the term sorcery because I enjoy it. I enjoy the way that it... I love the sound of the word sorcery. It's a beautiful sounding word. It sounds like exactly what it is. It sounds like incantations and spells and all of that hoodoo voodoo, but it also sounds like something much more abstract, something that connects us to the source, that comes from the source, and that is a movement. Sorcery sounds to me like something that is moving, the movement of energy, the movement of consciousness through the world. That's sorcery. Everything is constantly turning and turning, wheels within wheels. So I'm going off on a tangent now. Sorcery. I enjoy it also because it has negative connotations for many people, not just Christians, but so-called occult-minded people. It's become associated with evil, black magic, and all of that nonsense, which, as I've said many times before, the only form of black magic is unconscious sorcery, and that is what our fellow man performs day in and day out. Our fellow men are the black magicians. We don't need to worry about the old seers. As I said last week, they are subject to the laws of karma, the divine law, just as much as the rest of us. So to get on our high horse about what they're doing to us is completely beside the point and playing into their hands, in a sense, because as somebody wrote at my blog, if we just become sorcerers ourselves, then we'll claim that power that is being used against us now. It's our own ignorance and unconsciousness that keeps us enslaved. The old seers are simply exploiting that situation. It's a natural law. They are serving a natural law. So it's entirely irrelevant what anyone else is doing, including our fellow men, except so far as we are partaking of that black magic by agreeing with it, by subscribing to the lie that we are merely physical shells bound by the law of decay. This is only true up to a point. The physical body is, in a sense, contained by the law of decay. It is held by it. But there are other laws, the law of creation, the law of transformation, and these transcend the law of entropy. And the junk DNA, the 90% of the DNA that we don't understand, which sorcery is aimed towards activating, is a realm of physical being which is beyond entropy, which is on the other side of the barrier of decay, of entropy, of death. Death is the gatekeeper that keeps us from entering into this realm, the inorganic realms. Inorganic is not the same as non-physical. This is the key distinction, that the awarenesses that I speak of, angels and archangels who shape reality and whom we can connect with through our will, through our imagination, and work with together, the planets, the stars, the elements, the earth spirits, nature spirits, the dead, the ancestors. This is a very Halloween broadcast for y'all. They are... I forgot what I was going to say now. Damn. Halloween. They exist inorganically, but they are physical beings. Just the sound is a physical thing. And structure is much more subtle than we think of it, or it can be. The pyramids have structure, but so does the key of D played on your guitar strings. That creates structure in the void. And this is the kind of structure and the kind of physical existence that we are evolving towards now, oh my fellow holograms. And this is our destiny, to become sorcery. And being a sorcerer is merely an intermediary phase. It's essential to remember that it's not a goal, it's not an end, it's a means, sorcery. If it became the end, then it would be a dead end, and we would end up where the old seers have ended up. And this is why they have no choice but to exploit and siphon off our energy to keep themselves alive, immortal, temporarily immortal, because they are also lunar beings. They're lunar sorcerers, which is a scary, scary thing. I'm not pretending it isn't. And this is Halloween, so be afraid, be a little afraid, but use that fear to empower you. Because fear, when it's confronted, one has the option of putting it behind one, and then when one's fear is behind one, then it drives one forward into battle. It's still there. It's an active force like death, but it doesn't overwhelm us and it doesn't block us. So we embrace what we fear and we turn it into our allies. And so the demons become our helpers. I'm going to carry on reading now here because I've run out of spontaneous inspiration. Dark matter and junk DNA. Okay, here a little bit of science. Organic life grows by a process of cell division. According to the current biological model, before a cell divides, the DNA within that cell makes backup copies of all its information and sends it to a single molecule strand of RNA called messenger RNA. There is no degeneration through duplication, however, and the original code remains on the first cell while the backup copy is installed into the new cell, which then goes about its business and continues replicating. This means that every cell within an organism and within the greater organism of the universe contains a perfect copy of all the information, genetic memories, of every cell that has ever come before it. This lineage goes all the way back to the original cell. Biologists remain somewhat unclear how exactly a cell knows to read only that information pertinent to its particular formation, i.e. how a blood cell knows to behave like a blood cell and not like a cell in a liver or any other area of the body. But somehow, cells know what, or who, they are, and the rest of the genetic code they carry appears merely to provide a context within which to do their thing. This is paralleled exactly by the way we as individuals carry the genetic code of our ancestors and are shaped by that code indirectly without ever making use of it in a conscious fashion. This genetic lineage relates to the roughly 3% of coded DNA, i.e. that portion which biologists recognize as determining our genetic structure and directing the behavior of cells and organisms. The remaining 90% is unaccounted for. In other words, quote, "The vast majority of DNA in our bodies does things that we do not presently understand," end quote, Jeremy Narby. As Graham Hancock observes, "All we know for sure about these huge libraries of DNA is that they contain immense amounts of information written in exactly the same language as the genetic code, but in this case not coding for the construction of proteins or any other recognized function. Everything in existence is made up of and forms part of greater and smaller rings. Planets and stars both have their own rings and belong to larger rings around them. Cells of the body and subatomic particles also partake of this multitude. Taken in isolation, it may appear that the nature of a ring is simply to spin in the void and that all rings are going nowhere. In fact, as both a macrocosmic and microcosmic view of these phenomena reveals, in galaxies and DNA, all rings at least aspire to being part of a sequence, a spiral of ever greater, or ever smaller if descending, rings. The purpose of any given ring, then, is to hook itself to other rings of a similar type and become part of a sequence. It matters not where an individual ring is situated in this sequence, only that it be hooked to a larger ring above it, and, unless it be at the very end of the sequence, a lower ring below, thereby connecting the spiral and sustaining its motion. What is of the essence is that a ring aspiring to ascend be sure to hook itself to a spiral that is spinning upward to infinity and not downward into the infernal depths." Infernal brackets finite. This is, I think, very useful to consider in our moments of despair and uncertainty about where life and existence is going, and if it's just heading further down the pike to decay and death and disorder and entropy, as the scientists would have us believe, and that pure physical existence more than suggests but makes inescapable. The fact is that on the temperature scale there is a cutoff point for below zero temperatures. There is the temperature can decrease up to a point, and then that's it. It simply cannot go beyond that point. I don't actually know what that point is on the Earth. It may vary. I presume it relates to space in a vacuum, and the fact that in a vacuum, because space is very, very cold, I know that because I've seen it in the movies, I would guess that space can't really get any colder because there's no oxygen, there's no... Anyway, somebody can... hopefully will help me out on this at some point, somebody knows more about it. But the reason I bring it up is that on the temperature scale one can descend to a point and then no further. However, on the ascending curve there is no end to possible temperatures. There is no cutoff point for heat. It is infinite. And this relates to consciousness also, that consciousness can contract, that it can isolate itself to a point that it is completely frozen out of existence. And at that point, of course, it ceases to exist. That's the cutoff point for consciousness. If it continues in its path of contraction, of isolation, what we know of as damnation, at least the Christian folk among us, that's it. The only true damnation for consciousness is non-existence. There is no eternal hellfire. There is purgatory, which by definition must be temporary, however long it takes, because it's a process. And at the end of that process, we move out of the fires of purgatory and into a higher state. Purgatory, as such, isn't a place or even a state. It is the experience of our own impurity and our own resistance to the divine consciousness, that in the light of the divine consciousness, as it moves through us, which relates to Kundalini at a physical level, so far as there's impurities that are blocking that emergence, then we're going to experience it as a very traumatic, a very painful process. So on a very local, personal level, this is why many shamans and sorcerers who are consciously or not awakening their own Kundalini, and when I say consciously, I mean that they would be conscious that it's happening, but they may not be consciously intending that to happen. They may simply be working on other more mundane ends, simply working on their consciousness, on integrating those aspects of themselves that have been disowned, etc. But that will gather energy, and that energy will cause the Kundalini to awaken in the body. So then they will experience sickness. And this sickness is essentially, it's the mind's resistance to the body's awakening. It's the way that the body communicates to the mind what it is going through. Because the mind has created these blockages within the body through thought forms, through negative thought forms, negative emotional habits and patterns. These form clusters at energetic level, and these clusters are like grids which form a sort of net around the physical body, and there are entities who use these clusters, these grids, to siphon off our energy. So our body essentially becomes weaker and more afflicted because of all the energy that is being siphoned off by entities that are using these clusters of thought forms and emotional, negative emotional patterns that go back to childhood. And so our bodies essentially are enslaved. It's our energy bodies are trapped in the labyrinth of the penumbra, where the inorganic beings feed off them, and our physical bodies are experiencing all kinds of disorders as a result of this. So the key, the solution clearly is to free up our subtle bodies, our emotional and mental bodies, to clear out these clusters, to break apart these thought forms that we've created that are being used by vampiric entities to enslave us, entrap us, and to feed off us. Now, the process of awakening Kundalini, it's a chicken or an egg sort of thing, because if we awaken our Kundalini, it's going to break through these blockages, it's going to break apart these thought forms, and we're going to experience identity crisis and all the rest of it. And on the other hand, if we're working on breaking apart these negative patterns and owning these disowned aspects of our psyche, that in itself is going to free up the energy that's trapped there and allow the Kundalini, the divine consciousness, primal energy, the earth and sun, to awaken in our bodies. So it's a process there that it gathers momentum as we work on it. But the price of this and the danger of it is if we're slightly off balance, and it's very hard not to be off balance, then we're going to be awakening energy unconsciously, and we're going to be releasing trapped emotions before we're quite conscious of what we're doing, and so we don't necessarily have the option of processing that energy and that emotion that's moving through us, and so it can actually cause damage to the nervous system. And so this is premature Kundalini rising, but unfortunately we're all undergoing premature Kundalini rising now. Well, except for those of us who are lucky enough to have somehow had our spontaneous enlightenment experience or have been raised by seers and shamans. Those of us who are having to be self-activated sorcerers and haven't been zapped with a fairy wand and just got instantly to into the second attention or heightened awareness, we're on our own, really. And so essentially the only break we have is our suffering, physical, mental, emotional. That's what keeps us from advancing too rapidly. Because, of course, those of us who are seeking awakening, we're accelerating a process that's already accelerated. And so you might say we have no choice, we're compelled, but it is going to increase our distress. The awakening of Kundalini, the awakening of the second attention, of heightened awareness, it heightens everything, the experience of everything. And since the basic experience of humanity at this time is one of distress, then that's what we're going to be experiencing primarily, is our personal distress and the collective distress, and how the two are inextricably intertwined. So, how did I get on this tangent? I don't even know. The awakening of Kundalini through sorcery is a dangerous game, and the global crisis is no more, no certainly no less than this collective Kundalini awakening. But to bring it full circle, our pain, our suffering is finite. The agony of isolation is finite. It's temporary. Temporal and temporary. The joy and the bliss and the ecstasy of divine consciousness is infinite. We've just got to hold on and stay focused on the positive, stay focused on the infinite. And let's face it, there's a lot more of it. And not rush eternity. We may as well enjoy our suffering while it lasts, our isolation while it continues, because it is a very passing phase that we're going through. It's a temporary stage in our journey. And it is good for something. We're on our way to becoming the music of the spheres. Solar beings rolling through infinity. Okay, so I'm going to pass on, I'm going to move on now. The magical task is simple: to perfect our individual rings, make them strong and bright enough to attract other rings, equally as strong and bright as ours or more so, and then, and only then, hook onto dimmer rings to draw them into our rising momentum. First, we must take care of our own rings. Once we attract other rings to form a spiral with, the linking together takes care of itself, just as Jupiter and Saturn take care of themselves, and just as the various strands of DNA do their thing equally impeccably. Moving on, Judgment Day. As for the specifics of this magical operation, how we personally activate our second ring of power and awaken the sleeping DNA spiral, the answer is as follows. For the human animal to become a star, he or she must light up the ring of memory. Each individual's life traces an orbit in time, and this forms a four-dimensional ring termed by sorcerers the totality of the self. The totality of the self is made up of memories, both personal and ancestral, every last one of which is stored within the DNA of our bodies, from the first beginnings of man to this present moment in time, from Eden to Armageddon. This is memory and the totality of it. A human being with total recall is an activated link in a cosmic ring of memories. He is Christ and Lucifer, serpent and God in one, bringing the light. There is nothing besides this ring of memories, this dance of atoms. Each of us gives our individual spin to that ring, flavoring the tale and playing our individual song. But the instrument, the memory, is not ours. Like magic, it can never be ours, because those memories are us. That is all we ever need to be, links in a chain, in a vast intergalactic, multi-cosmic, stellar-powered evolutionary spiral that spins and winds its way through the vortex of death to infinity. The goal of magic is to remember, and remembrance means to make one's individual ring, the body-soul, strong enough to link to an ascending spiral and pull through the abyss of space until zero gravity is reached. Beside that, our task is simply to sit back, hold tight, and enjoy the ride. That's my advice to you all out there. Buckle up for safety. Right, moving on through our thesis. Okay. The present work will attempt to tie all of this together into a sequence, a process by which human beliefs have adapted and evolved in order to survive, even while human consciousness has expanded, though also, as we shall see, contracted, and the human organism has begun to mutate. Such a sequence has already been described loosely as a process of rings inside a spiral circling upward along the order of the planets within the solar system, through the sun and into the galaxy. At a more occult, hence intimate level, however, the image pertains to the human body itself and to the mystical force known by Hindus as Kundalini, symbolized by a serpent. According to yogic doctrine, as the Kundalini serpent rises up the spine from the root to the crown, it is said to activate 7 energy centers, chakras, within the human body, thereby reconnecting it to the cosmos. As it happens, each of the chakras corresponds with one of the 7 primary planets. This waking of the snake is a more esoteric, less poetic description of the myth central to the present work, and if I am right, to human existence. The myth of the serpent who loses and regains his wings. As such, all that follows may be no more nor less than a complex, dramatic summation of the historic events which reflect, at a global level, the internal process of Kundalini rising within the collective body of humanity. It is the moment in which the snake regains his wings. I have been hard-pressed to find an adequate model or metaphor for this process besides those already cited. The obvious one, steps of a ladder, at which the snake may then climb, creates a false, hence deceptive, linearity, when what we are describing is far more a lateral than literal process. I have settled upon rings or turns inside a spiral, since all of nature would seem to support and be founded upon this basic model. What is really happening here in our minds, bodies, and souls, mistakenly described as history, is the process by which DNA becomes conscious of itself. It is my attempt to map the discovery of what Hancock calls a control system for the human race that is not of this earth, that is serpent-like in form, and that now dwells inside us, and that is superior to all of us. As the creator of all that is, the DNA has until now been dormant within us, a building block of living matter. But what if this building block were to evolve itself in the act of building, to assume not a passive but an active role in the creation process? I suggest that this is precisely what has been occurring by slow, steady degrees over the past 7,000 years of recorded history, and that such an event is now reaching the critical phase, a phase in which the entire DNA spiral will light up within each of us and begin spinning new worlds into being. The chicken is an egg's way of making more eggs, and maybe human beings, organic life, are just the DNA's way of getting around. In a holographic universe, the fragment contains the whole, just as the whole contains the fragment. Human DNA consists of all the information, the records, that make up human history, since the beginning and through countless prehistoric cycles. If such information is stored inside our own bodies, why wouldn't it be available to us as individuals? And as a living DNA coil within the body of the universe, wouldn't the human organism contain all the knowledge accumulated by the universe since the beginning of time? Seen in such a light, the universe is a vast, unimaginably intelligent hunter-gatherer of information, and man is the primary means by which it gathers. Doesn't that just make you want to get up in the morning? A purpose in life. The oldest, most primal purpose of them all, hunting and gathering, but not nuts and berries or bison, but energy, power, knowledge, wisdom, experience. The miracles of creation that are created, not for our entertainment, but for our inspiration, for our exploration. We are simply coagulated vessels of spirit, and we are guided by spirit through this realm of matter as a way to experience this realm. As the way for spirit to experience it, we don't need an agenda of our own. We don't need goals. We don't need purposes. We don't need ends. We don't need plans. We don't need anything. All we need to do is open up to it, this fantastic, miraculous, mystery creation in which we are entangled now and forever. And that is our future. This whole enlightenment game has been cunningly distorted into one more carrot and one more whip to drive us forward, when in essence the realization of one's nature, self-activation, is not work, it's just play. It's just no different from a newborn baby exploring its environment. That is what we are on the verge of becoming now, as cosmic babies, about to be midwifed into a whole new creation, a whole new realm, because this is our womb, this planet Earth, this universe as we know it, this three-dimensional physical organic universe, is a matrix, a womb and a chrysalis, which we are gestating. And it is a painful process. We're actually experiencing birth pangs from the inside now, and I think we have been for the last few hundred years. It's such a huge, vast, cosmic cycle that is coming to an end now. It's a cycle that has begun millions of years ago. Millions of years ago. It's nearing its end now in our lifetime. Just contemplate the wonder of that. And inevitably then, what is just a moment, just a matter of minutes on a human scale, a moment of birth, although even that can take hours if there's complications, on a cosmic scale that's going to take hundreds of years. And it may be that the last few thousand years even, recorded history of the birth process, certainly the last period of gestation, which we've developed fully isolated ego cells, and that has caused the chrysalis to harden, hardened sufficiently to become brittle, to crack open in time for the spreading of our new butterfly wings. But as I say, you know, the caterpillar that is broken down to pulp inside the chrysalis doesn't have a clue what's happening. And it's not a pleasant process to be broken down to liquids, but I would wager that even more painful and even more distressing is that final period in which the butterfly is fully formed but has no idea what it is. It has the memories of being a caterpillar. It has no idea what being a butterfly would feel like. All it can feel is the pressure of that chrysalis, which has become almost unbearable because itself has grown into this butterfly that is now pushing against the restrictive matrix that contains it, just as a baby must push out of the womb in order to be born. And this is a distressful process, and so our distress is increasing, but we are in the last phases, we are in the last stages of this process, and we simply need to find our wills. We need to become passive as the babe in the womb is passive and allow the contractions to push us out, and yet at the same time we must be intending ourselves out. Because in the moment in which we are born, then that's it. We are not on our own. We will be taken care of in this new realm, because we will just be these cosmic babies. But we are individual beings at that point, in a way that we have not even imagined in our lives thus far. The irony is that we think of ourselves as individuals now, but really we're just a collective. We're just part of a great big mass mind. We haven't individuated. And paradoxically, symmetrically, when we are fully birthed as cosmic individual beings, we will enter into collective, to full consciousness of being a collective. Because only by becoming individuals can we connect to the great cosmic symphony of divine consciousness that is the underlying structure of the universe, like stars in the firmament that are connected by their light. Without being individual, isolate stars, they would have no reason to shine. So we need this individuation. We need to leave the womb, what we know of as humanity, and enter into our cosmic being. Yeah. Onward and upward we go. The snake of human consciousness is about to shed its skin and spread its wings. Homo serpens, thy time has come. The moment the spirit serpent has descended all the way into matter and so come to know it, is the moment the serpent changes its spin, reclaims its wings, and begins the return journey with trophies. This is the moment in which human DNA, having attained a full understanding of the organic realm, spins itself a new vessel and enters into the undiscovered country of the inorganic realms. Okay, well, I'm going to finish up soon, getting near the end of the hour, hearing the thoughts of a deranged and demented mind as it tunes into galactic frequency and tries to retain its semblance of sanity and individual identity, and just navigate the day-to-day struggles and challenges and obstacles of tying my shoelaces and paying my bills and making the ends meet. It ain't easy, folks. It ain't easy to get to heaven when you're going down, but it's the only way that we can be sure when we get to heaven, having been all the way through hell, it's the only way we can be sure that we are ready and that we can remain, that we have dealt with and processed all of that negativity, all of that denial. We must experience full contraction before we can begin the expansion process without being checked by doubt or uncertainty about whether maybe we'd like to just stay separate individuals. Maybe we'd like to just crawl up and die and stay in our little dirty, ugly, dark shells of identity a little bit longer. It's only when we've hit rock bottom that we're ready to ascend. That's just common sense, isn't it? So let's just keep heading for the bottom. Just keep heading for the bottom. And just hold our breath and trust that when we get to the bottom, we'll still have enough strength to kick off and head back to the surface. Because if we resist the downward pull, it's going to take us down anyway, but we're going to tar ourselves up trying to get back out, trying to pull out. Surrender. Surrendering to the divine is easy. We have to surrender to the satanic. We have to surrender to the darkest, most evil, most repulsive aspects of our being and just open wide to them and let them enter into us and fill us with their revolting, satanic, diabolical filthiness. Because how else are we going to own them and integrate them and transform them and redeem them? We can't do it by pushing them away. And then they'll just keep trying to come back and keep trying to come back until we're exhausted from pushing them away, and then they win. You see, because these powers of darkness can't do anything to us. They can just make us do ourselves in, resisting them and fighting them and fearing them and loathing them. If we stay in the kind of negative mindset and the reactive behavior that they want us to, that they cause in us, then that is what will defeat us. That is the only way that we can be defeated. But if we open to these forces and these beings, then they are powerless. They are powerless to do anything to us. Because divine law protects us. Divine law protects each and every one of us. We are individual fragments of the divine. It's not even protection. There's nothing that needs protecting. There's nothing to protect. There's nothing to protect ourselves from. This is an illusion that is sustained by a world built around separation. That's a good thing to bear in mind. It's a rule to live by, that there is nothing that is not of spirit. There is nothing that is not holy, that is not part of the totality, because if it wasn't part of the totality, it couldn't exist. And so there is nothing that can harm us or pollute us or contaminate us except what we do to ourselves by resisting those things that we think will do these things to ourselves. And it's a very hard truth to live, very hard truth to even understand if you're coming from a place of the head and the intellect. But in the heart knows full well that everything wants to be loved. Everything responds to love. Absolutely everything. Because it's the universal energy. It's the creative life force. And there is no force greater in the universe because there is no other force in the universe. Entropy and decay and death and evil and darkness and denial and despair are not independent or autonomous forces. They're simply reactions or resistance to the primal an original force of love or creation. In the same way that the undertow in the ocean is a reaction to a wave, it's a side effect of a wave. The bigger the wave, the bigger the undertow. You can't have one without the other. But the undertow is nothing to fear if we surrender to the wave, because the wave will always take us with us. But we have to surrender to the undertow in order to surrender to the wave, because the undertow comes first. And that's where we're at now. Planet Earth, 2008, the end times. We are feeling the pull of the undertow. The forces of darkness are drawing us in, and we must let them. Because the forces of darkness are nothing less than the forces of the unconscious. And this is the source of all that we are. It's not some separate, parasitical, evil conspiracy that is trying to trick us and trap us and enslave us. That is a secondary experience once it's filtered through the ego and the personal self, etc. And that is a reality too, but it's a secondary reality. And it only has any reality at all if we are able to get past it to the primary reality. If we stay locked in it, it will become real. But it is what makes it so enslaving and so oppressive is that it is essentially unreal. It has no reality of itself. And so we become as trapped and as isolated as the old seers themselves, by believing in their illusion. And that is not a good idea. There is really no benefits to be had from staying locked into perception of good and evil. As long as we're fighting and resisting and judging what we see as wrong in our world, in others and in ourselves, then we're simply making it stronger. We're giving it power. Giving it reality. We're allowing it to define our reality and our existence. And it simply doesn't work as a way of overcoming. In order to overcome something, we must be totally neutral about it. So this is the Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. It's not an inability to discriminate between good and evil. It's a simple absence of personal feeling or judgment about good and evil. So good and evil become positive and negative forces that are part of a single force, magnetism. Eros and Agape, the two aspects of love. Divine love, physical love, love and lust even. Love and will was another polarity which is true, masculine and feminine. Our idea that there's right and wrong and good and evil is absurd as thinking that women are evil and men are good, or vice versa, or that black is bad and white is good, or that darkness is evil and daylight is good. We have a preference, that's all it is. Simple preference. Nothing wrong with the preference, provided we're not trapped in it, and provided we don't turn it into some system by which to impose on others, and by which to define ourselves. Because there's no possibility of evolution then. No possibility of fluidity or spontaneity. We're no longer relating to what's going on around us. We're simply interpreting it, judging it. We only have a relationship with our own beliefs, thoughts and opinions at that point. So we've become isolated. And it's a deeply oppressive state to be in. So let it go. Let it go. Just let everything be what it is. And we might then find that we can be what we are also. We don't have to judge ourselves as inadequate or lacking in any way, because we are exactly what we need to be in this moment. How could it be any other way? It couldn't. Only the mind is constantly dissatisfied with what we are and with what we're given. That is a disease. That is a disorder. Well, bloody waste of time. Anyway, okay, so I'm going to look for a last little passage now to read to you before I sign off for one more week. DMT, Salvia Divinorum, not going to go into that this time. Near-death experiences, collective memories, lineage. In John 14:26 there appears an obscure term, "But the Paraclete, which is the Holy Ghost, whom the Father will send in my name, he shall teach you all things and bring all things to your remembrance." This mysterious substance is also called the Comforter. The first point to understand about the Paraclete is that, as Philip K. Dick went to great pains to communicate, there are two universes. According to Dick, the universe in which we live is the secondary universe, an offshoot of the first, the shadow or reflection of original unfallen existence. We might call this surrogate second-rate universe B-reality. The Paraclete is the sacred gene, the divine virus, the Holy Spirit, translated also as consoler in the Bible, consolation for getting stiffed with a second-rate reality, perhaps. It is responsible for humanity's remembering its true nature as God. From a magical perspective, the vast amount of knowledge, memories, amassed by humankind at this time does not serve to bring us closer to our apotheosis as a species or to self-realization as God. In current terminology, it neither advances nor enhances the program, only jams it up with excess and useless data. At the great rebooting, this useless data will be flushed, and as a result of, contingent upon and simultaneous with, this flushing of collective memories, a new flow of hitherto lost or blocked information will occur. At this point, the program becomes self-installing, and the hard drive, the collective unconscious of humanity, becomes conscious of itself and of its true pre-programmed initiative or agenda. This agenda, as the word suggests, is genetic, instinctive and not rational. It is conscious in a way that the intellect not only has not imagined but cannot imagine, conscious not merely of the part but of the whole. The effect of the Paraclete or Comforter is difficult either to predict or describe. When Christ infected humanity with his word, humanity became a carrier for the Logos. Apparently the nature of this mutation is so alien that humanity chooses to forget or dismiss its experiences as inconsistent with what it knows as real. In fact, none of this is real, only the plasmate is real. Glosnosis, speaking in tongues, and other reactions to the Holy Spirit that appear to the skeptical observer as little different from epileptic attacks, indicate the strange manner with which the human body reacts to the plasmate, as if turning from within. The Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, an earlier carrier of the plasmate, apparently experienced epiphanies of divine knowledge while his body thrashed helplessly in the throes of epilepsy, suggesting that his vehicle was not sufficiently prepared for the quickening. Likewise, if the mind is not suitably resilient and uncluttered a vessel for the plasmate to emerge through, it will be deranged and unhinged by the experience. It will retain only a twisted and sinister image of the truth, a devil in place of a god. The consciousness of Homo plasmate would contain the complete DNA code, including all ancestral memories from the beginning of time, from the very first amoeba on up. Individual awareness will expand to fill infinity. Well, on that note, I'm going to wish you all a happy, happy, happy Halloween, and I'm going to say farewell and adieu for one more week. This is Aeolus Cephas. This is Stormy Weather, and these are the end times.
I live a life that's working for me. What I respect, you just can't see. What you expect, I'll never be. That's how I live. Primitive. I take what you give. 'Cause I love and I live. I'm proud of my life, but I've probably been that ill. That's how I